Welcome to World Anti-Extremism Network's scholarly podcast on ideas for countering extremism and authoritarianism. Madrasas, extremism, and Islam. Historically, madrasas have served as vital centers of learning and shaping Islamic thoughts and culture. They have produced influential thinkers and leaders, playing a crucial role in developing, expanding, and preserving Islamic jurisprudence, theology, astronomy, analogy, and other scientific subjects. However, the narrative has shifted in recent years as some madrasas have been linked to the spread of radical ideologies among Muslim youth and societies. While many madrasas continue to promote a balanced education and social responsibility, others have become platforms for extremist views, often driven by political or socioeconomic factors. In this episode, we will discuss how these dynamics motivate some young people to embrace radical opinions with our fellow guest, Dr. Hassan Abbas. Dr. Hassan Abbas is a distinguished professor of international relations at the Near East South Asia Strategic Studies Center at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. He also serves as a senior advisor to Harvard University's Waterhead Center for International Affairs and Asia Society. His current research focuses on developing narratives to counter political and religious extremism in reforming the rule of law in developing states. Dr. Abbas has held significant academic positions, including professor and department chair at the National Defense University's College of International Security Affairs and distinguished Qaidi Azam professor at Columbia University. With a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, he has been a fellow at prestigious institutions, including Harvard and the Carnegie Endowment. A recognized commentator on security issues, Dr. Abbas has appeared on major news networks and has testified before the U.S. congressional committees. He also runs Watan Dost, an educational blog focused on religion, politics, and security in Southeast Asia. Dr. Abbas is the author of the influential book, The Return of the Taliban. Welcome, Dr. Abbas, to WEN's podcast. I would like to start with the question that how have madrasas historically contributed to Islamic knowledge, civilization, and cultural identity?
Thank you so much for this opportunity and very kind of you for a detailed background. I would start by saying madrasas, as you have also alluded to rightly, have played a very significant role in not only religious development, but also in terms of jurisprudence, what we call Sharia, the Islamic law, as well as in a cultural context. Madrasas also historically were the hubs where Muslims from all across the world were getting connected to each other. Because as we know, Islam had started as a religion from Arabia, from Hijaz. And initially, all Muslims were from Mecca and Medina. And then it started expanding the Persians. And then with wars and with many interactions globally, people from very different backgrounds started becoming Muslims. So the initial madrasas in those years, I'm talking about first 3 to 4 centuries, this was the hub where people would come and get, because they all came with their own cultural context, their own understanding of religion from their previous religions. So madrasa was the hub which allowed them to internalize what Islam is. However, it was not an institution which was developed in any strong structural fashion. For example, I'll just give a few examples and then come to the point in a minute or so. I would argue the first madrasa was the very sitting of our beloved Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, where people were sitting in front of him and asking him questions when the verses of Quran, the divine revelation was coming in and the Prophet was explaining it to the people. What does this mean? What the new instructions are? That was the first madrasa. And that was the institution where people were asking questions. They were trying to understand. And then they had the personality of the Prophet to see that this is how these divine instructions are implemented. That went on in the initial years of Islam during the first, I would argue, the first, the Khulafa'i Rashidin or the first four caliphs also. There is no history that there was an institution like a school. It was the religious scholars who happened to be the companions of the Prophet, or the Ahlul Bayt, who were the family of the Prophet, the spiritual inheritors of the message. They were the ones who in their individual capacity were seen as the great jurists, as the great scholars, and people were coming to them. We know that it was only after the first about 200 years that the first signs of a madrasa came about. And it is insightful, and this came to this, I realized this quite recently when I did some research on for one of my books called The Prophet's Heir, The Life of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is a biography of the fourth caliph of Islam and the first imam for the Shia Muslims. And I learned that during the times of the fifth or sixth imams in the Shia tradition, but also in the Al-Sunnah tradition, Imam Jafar Sadiq and his father, Imam Baqir, they established their first centers in Medina. It was the wife of Imam Baqir who was also teaching. So the first madrasas were established, I would say, in the first 250 years or so. And women were also the teachers. And when I read this for the first time, I went deep into it, asked many people, looked at the sources, and I was amazed at the beginning of these madrasas. Also, this is the time when the Umayyads and the Abbasids, then that's the first time that madrasas took shape kind of in a proper institution, which was a teaching institution where people were getting together, and Baghdad became the center of excellence. And all that you will hear about the historical madrasa institution, you will find its roots in Baghdad. And there also, initial madrasa, and this is my last point on this first question, the madrasa was above any sectarian leanings. I've read about, for example, the first schools of Islam in terms of the Sunni jurisprudence of Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i. The first four schools also were established with, in parallel to the Jafri school, Jafar Sadiq. They were all the top scholars, were all students. The four Sunni imams out of them, the three were students of Jafar Sadiq, who became the, in a sense, founder of the Jafri school of thought. The point I'm making is the initial years, or in the initial centuries, madrasa was developed very slowly and gradually, and it was above any sectarian leanings. It was above any, in fact, in a kind of a gender sense also, as I had mentioned, women scholars as well. So madrasa was a hub not only of education, but of bringing people together and of innovation as well. Some of the most famous scholars from, I can name so many of them, who were known as the pioneers of Islamic sciences and physical sciences, whether in physics and chemistry, the original forms of these educational or these kind of fields of study, they all came about from the madrasa. So that history, I thought I'll take a few minutes to mention. The background and the historical foundation of these madrasas was very open, pluralistic, educational, and focused on excellence in and knowledge.
Thank you, Dr. Aseb. Really, you touched upon very key points from the beginning. As the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he was the main founder of madrasa because people around him studied from what he was quoting from the God and also saying based on his hadith and his sunnah. And later, his family, the Imam Jafar Sadiq in other belonging to his noble family, he played a very significant role. Indeed, in the history of Islam, we can also see the establishment of Baghdad Madrasa, as you have mentioned, the Nizamiya Madrasa in Baghdad, which was established in 1065 year in Abbasid time. And also, we can see the important role of Ulughubek Madrasa, which was not only focused on the Sharia thoughts, but also it was a scientific center for astronomy. And this madrasa was in Bukhara and Samarkand. In recent years, we can see the important role in our region of these madrasas in Deobandi Madrasa, which plays a very significant role in promoting of Islamic Sharia. But unfortunately, in recent years, as I mentioned earlier, that the role of these madrasas, particularly the Deobandi Madrasa, somehow changed in our region. If you please compare a little bit about the previous role of madrasas, as you have mentioned, and scientific and religious thoughts, in the current role of some madrasas, by presenting some sort of trainings for radical groups, for extremist groups to do some activities in the society, some radicalist activities, some terrorist activities, and somehow created a very bad defamation for Islam, for Islamic Sharia, and created Islamic phobia and other kind of fear in the Western societies about Islam. If you please contribute a little bit on the current rule and previous rule.
this background that I had mentioned and you had also mentioned is extremely important to understand, because if you compare that historical idea of a madrasa to the contemporary madrasa, these are two different worlds. I would not say all the degeneration has happened across, but in a very, very significant fashion. The madrasa today is no match to the historical madrasa. There are some exceptions, of course. I'll mention, for example, institutions like Al-Azhar University, which is also a madrasa. The institution also, some of the institutions that I visited in Najaf might be beyond that. But the tradition, I'll jump to the South Asian experience. South Asia, the Arabs maintained it through the Fatimids' time and later on Al-Azhar, which remained kind of very pluralistic. Historically, in between the golden era of madrasa that I had mentioned, and coming to the present, there is, of course, a large time in between, 1,000 years. I'll just say 2-3 things and then I'll come to the Deobandi madrasa, because these are linked. The middle period is the period where Ottomans, Safavids, Mughals adopted these institutions, and somehow, tragically, in the middle age, or the middle age in the Islamic history in the sense of last 1400 years, madrasa started becoming associated with whosoever is in power. And that happened under Ottomans. Ottomans, but to give credit where due, did a great job, actually. They tried to maintain the rather independence of madrasa to a great extent. Turkey and or the Ottomans became a new hub. It moved from the Arab world, because the Umayyads and Abbasids, even though investing hugely in this, were also trying to then adopt and co-opt. So there was a time when so many scholars started coming on the payrolls of whosoever is the Amir or leader of a nation. So a problematic development also started early on. But in the time of these great empires, Ottomans, Safavids, Mughals, even Fatimids, sectarianism started creeping in slowly and gradually, but not in a violent fashion. It was just that because different schools of thought came about, the Maliki and Shafi, and as I had mentioned, and Hanafi. So in Morocco, in Africa, it was the Maliki system. In South Asia, it was the Hanafi system. In other places, the other great schools of thought that I had mentioned, in the Iran after Safavids, the Shia school of thought, and in Iraq and some parts of the Middle East. And they all started making their own sects or school of jurisprudence. They only started investing in their own school. And the interaction between scholars of different regions and different schools of thought started lessening with time. So this happened over a period of 300-400 years, when, for the lack of any other word, divisiveness in religious thought started getting penetrated. In South Asia, it was made obvious through two schools of thought, the Barelvi school of thought and the Deobandi school of thought. These are very modern schools of thought. These were in 19th and 20th century that they kind of really got established. So this is, we are talking about last 200 years actually, in which the madrasa from this historical sense came about in this region. These were also linked to colonialism, because they were also linked to schools of thought. Both Barelvi and Deobandi, for example, are from Sunni Hanafi tradition. However, one was more inclined towards the mystical or the Sufi world, which was the Bareli. These are both names of places, Bareli and Deoband. These are two small towns in present-day India from where these institutions were built. And then they adopted a new curriculum. And then the modern South Asian madrasa came about. Even then, it was the scholarship level was quite high. It was, these are political oriented also, because they were linked to colonialism. One group was anti-British colonialism in the last, like I would argue, 100, 150 years. And the other one was more influenced from Central Asia, Afghanistan. And I must add, Afghanistan and Central Asia were the hubs of modern Islamic scholarship. When the wars that happened in Middle East, or today's Middle East, but I would argue the Arab world, scholarship had moved to Uzbekistan. Some of what we know of Samarkand and Bukhara, some of the most modern madrasas and scholars, basically scholars migrated into this region. Any major modern Muslim mystical group that you'll think about had its foundation in today's Afghanistan. And I'm emphasizing this because a modern person or a Western person today would think it inconceivable with all what they hear about Afghanistan to think that, no, Afghanistan was once a place where all scholars from Central South Asia and the Arab world would come. And this is also important to mention because then it helps us understand the contrast which today's madrasa brings. The Deoband madrasa, very briefly, was scholarly in its tradition. Then the partition of India and Pakistan happened, and some of the Deobandi school, which were within the Hanafi school, there were hardly 30%. If you ask me, just as an example I'm giving, both in India and Pakistan, if there are 100 Muslims in Pakistan, let's say, out of them about, you would say, 25% you keep on the Jafri school, Shia side, out of the 75% or 80% Sunni schools, out of that 80%, I would think 70 to 80% were with the Barelvi school of thought of Sunni Islam, and only 20-25% were with Deoband school. They moved their madrasas to Karachi and to Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province or Northwest Frontier province. And here, tragically, in the last 75 years, the Deobandi Hanafi school of thought's curriculum and education moved in a very problematic side because this got linked to regional politics. This got linked to, inverted commas, a modern idea of jihad. And the whole idea of scholarship, learning, changed into a new institution, which has now become quite degraded, problematic, divisive, and if I may dare say, linked to the production line of hate mongers. And only one example I'll give, then I'll stop for your next question. There's a famous book by a Pakistani general, Lieutenant General Kamal Mateenuddin, who wrote the first book on Taliban. And there are many new books on Taliban by Ahmed Rashid. I made a humble contribution also, but many Western scholars have done. But the first really insightful book was by Oxford University Press, by a Pakistani general, who writes in his book that after the Afghan jihad, and I'm saying it in inverted commas because this is how it was pitched against the Soviet Union, after that, when General Ziaul Haq, the Pakistani military dictator from 1979 to 88, when he realized that all these refugees and migrants are coming from, Muhajireen are coming from Afghanistan because of war, he said, we can't allow them to come into Pakistan. Let's build a chain of madrasas on Pakistan-Afghanistan border, which is today's, previously it was federally administered tribal areas. Today it is part of Pakistan's Northwest Frontier province or Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. He said that I'm exactly borrowing the words from his book. He said there's change of these tens of thousands of madrasas so that all the orphans of these Muhajireen and refugees are living there. We will get them into this education so that we convert them into fighters, and someday they go back in Afghanistan and fight the Soviets, because he thought the Soviets are never going to go back. And that how they built those madrasas. In that region, there was not much tradition of madrasas. Then they went to the Deobandi school in the region. They went to the Western world. They went to Saudi Arabia. They said they begged and borrowed money. And the purpose of this new chain of madrasas was to create not top jurists or scholars, but to create people who have just enough rudimentary knowledge that you can just tell them about, okay, jihad is what you mean, rather than jihad is the internal spiritual upbringing. It is jihad. No, that is not, which was the original meaning of jihad, which was effort. They said, no, jihad is an armed militancy. And that's where the modern day madrasa, and this is hardly 50 years ago, this new problematic trend of a madrasa came about in South Asia.
Thank you, Dr. Asif, for your very rich description about the background of madrasas in different periods of Islamic history. And also, as conclusion, we found that madrasas somehow used as a political tool for the particular political agendas in our region, as you have mentioned. Let's talk a little bit about the curriculum and subjects nowadays somehow teaching in these madrasas. As I understand, the past Hanafi school was known as a school of thought for open dialogue, freedom of speech, because another name of the Hanafi school of thought was Ahlul Rai, people of opinion, who have a free opinion to discuss the issues. But unfortunately, in recent years, as you touched also a little bit on that, the curriculum and the methodology of madrasa somehow shifted from being pure Hanafi somehow a little bit to the Ahl Hadith side, which also affected on the curriculum, because nowadays there are certain round, they call that round, small round and big round. In the small round, they are studying certain books. In the big round, they are studying the big Hadith books. And then they are graduating their students as mullahs or maulawis, and they are playing their crucial role in the society, in our society, in Pakistan, Israel, in other countries around our neighboring countries. And also they are playing their role of motivating youths for these jihadist purposes. I think the curriculum is very important. And despite of all attempts by Pakistani government, even sometime when there was democratic system in Afghanistan by Afghan government, they couldn't change the curriculum of these madrasas in a proper way. Still, there is a shortage of modern subjects in the madrasas. Still, they're following this classical style. Still, they're reading those books they published or somehow written 5th century or 6th century, a few years, 100 years ago. And no one has the right to touch on these books. They're just teaching these books without having freedom of speech or free dialogue space in these madrasas. While we can see in Baghdad, in other golden era of Islamic history, there was free dialogue, free speech, discussion on very controversial issues among Islamic scholars. This is one issue. And second point is the financial sources for these madrasas. That's another question. And also the environmental or the attitude, the space where these students are studying in these madrasas. It's mainly male-dominated environment. There is no gender perspective respected in these madrasas, only male-dominated society. And that's why most of these Taliban and these radical groups, they hate women. They are not in interaction with women, and they don't like that. And they are, when they came in power, they are also imposing their laws and their rules on society, trying to do some this gender segregation in the society and impose restriction on women and girls' education. Let's touch on these three issues. Curriculum first, learning environment, and funding sources of these madrasas.
Thank you so much. These are excellent points. And I see that, mashallah, you are also extremely not only well-read on these issues, but you have made it much easier for me to focus on the critical areas because of your knowledge and wisdom. These are extremely three important things. But connecting these three, the challenge of curriculum, on which I'll use first very short words and then try to make the connection. On curriculum, if I can have to say only one thing, that is that the degeneration of religious thought in Islam is the biggest crisis, because there is no new thinking. As we say, the doors of ijtihad. Ijtihad means modern interpretation or the dynamic or continuous scholarship that comes from a certain religious field. That openly, you'll go to any religious scholars and they'll tell you, this is a famous sentence, we closed the doors of ijtihad 5 centuries ago or 10 centuries ago, whatever different schools of thought may argue, which tells you that it means the curriculum will automatically become quite dogmatic and stuck in the era which is 500 years or 600 years or 800 years ago. Because you are saying, no new interpretation, because those Muslims 700 years ago, let's say as an example, were the most brilliant, were the most wise, and they looked at everything conceivable and have come up with something which the next 20 generations for next 5,000 years will learn. And that's the biggest tragedy that has happened with the curriculum, because of this notion that a certain era scholarship will become relevant for everything. Islam had come as a very dynamic, modern, pluralistic, inclusive religion. And they have converted that into a dogma. And it's very painful for me to present it like that, but I can't think of any other words. The learning environment, absolutely. You have put the finger on the heart of the matter. It has become, there's lack of critical thinking, there's lack of questioning. It is linked to rote learning. Today, if you see madrasa documentaries, not only in the West, but in the East also. West has also played its part in demeaning Islam in many ways, tragically, because of its lack of knowledge and lack of awareness. But Muslims themselves have been bigger culprits in this regard. Because look at any of these documentaries and you'll see these young kids which are just moving their head very frequently because they are rote learning Quran without understanding a word of it. Rather than teaching Arabic, they are making them robots who are just repeating words. I mean, our faith is, we believe every word of Quran, every dot of Quran is divine, and repeating that and reciting that brings the greatest of blessings, and that is an ibadah or blessing and prayer in itself. But that doesn't mean that you stop learning the meaning of it, because then it becomes empty in terms of your understanding and internalizing it. And the third point on gender, we have converted these into male-dominated things. The local customs, the local ideas, this whole idea of monopolization when it comes to gender roles is another tragedy that has taken. And this is also linked to this notion that, okay, 700 years ago, if the madrasa in Baghdad had no women, and which I challenge it, because these things were projected in a certain way because of certain political goals and certain sectarian goals as well. Coming to the very present, and this is, of course, all the three things I mentioned are about the present. The biggest, I think, challenge was that these madrasas were linked to different religious political parties, whether in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. Central Asia was lucky because they were Soviet system. I'm saying it in a sarcastic way. Because they said, okay, no religion. So the madrasa got stuck in a certain age. And the Central Asians, because they are not kind of male-dominated in a different sense, they are still. But they, the madrasa was saved, or whatever the remnants of madrasa were saved. But in South Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan primarily, to some extent in other places in the region as well, in Al-Azhar and in Iran and Iraq as well. I can tell you, these countries, it is a problem across sects that this has become very male-dominated phenomena. And I'll just give you one example why I think this is absolutely a wrong direction. During the times of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his early times after him, women used to go and pray in mosques along with men. Today, I can't give you an example of one mosque that I've been in the region. Maybe one or two, but 99%, I should say, painfully. You'll not see women going to a mosque even for Friday prayers. This is exactly opposite of what was happening during the times of the Prophet. So, thrown women out of the religious space because it's a male-dominated space. Madrasa, they cannot dare allow women because how come these arbiters of the religious destiny allow women to become religious scholars? That would be the biggest heresy and apostasy for them. So that's the tragedy, that this is in direct conflict with the original principles of Islam. Some institutions are doing it. I know some, there are madrasas in Iran, for example. Also, there are some in Pakistan as well now, to give credit where due. There's a, in Islamabad also, if you may remember, the Red Mosque crisis. And that's another issue. The first women madrasa, and that was in Islamabad, led to that whole crisis, which led to the Red Mosque crisis, where the whole mosques and area, the Red Mosque, where I have prayed in that mosque many a times. And I have seen those changes 20, 30 years ago. Then it had become a hub of extremism and became such a big problem that the Pakistan government had to bomb it. I'm not supporting violence in even curbing these trends, but the if ever there has to be a madrasa reform, it will have to change all those three things. Curriculum, government cannot dare change curriculum because, this is my final point under this question, because religious political parties are now the stakeholders. They need people to bring out on the streets. They have no constituency of their own. These madrasa students, who they manipulate, who they just manage or own their minds in many cases, because these are young kids from rural areas whose parents send them in most cases because there is no other education opportunities for them. Those innocent young boys, they come to these places, are then brainwashed. Some madrasas are trying to make a change. I mean, I don't want to throw all of them under the table. I was recently, just one example, I had a chance to go to the Haqqaniya Madrasa. I had written about it for a long time, always criticizing them. And this time, about 6 months ago, I had a chance to go there. And they asked me to give a lecture on Islam in America. And I mentioned to them that some of the best scholarship on Islam is happening in the West. And I was asked, why you say this? How we have all these Islamic centers and madrasas, and you are telling us that the best scholarship on Islam is happening in the West? And I said, yes, because there is critical thinking. Because no one is scared to death that somebody will come and kill them for saying something. So they are very open-minded. That's why some of the books on Islam produced in Europe and in North America and Canada and United States in a free environment are some of the best works. I give them credit. They said, please get all those books to us and we will put those in our library. So I appreciate what Madrasa Haqqani responded. But I went to another big madrasa in Lahore. And I went to their library, which was the beautiful building, four floors, amazing new building, very modern madrasa. And I asked them, okay, I want to go to the English section. They looked at me and they said, what? Why should we have an English section? I said, so you are creating imams and top scholars. You think there's nothing produced in English language that is of value? They said, no, but our guys cannot read English. And I was really stunned. In any case, we had a good conversation and they promised to start. And I realized, based, I'm not trying to project that I have done something good. What I'm saying is that I was amazed that at times some madrasas might be open to ideas. I think people are also so much scared of them. And from the side of the liberals or non-religious people, there's also hatred about these madrasa students, so much so that we don't interact with them. And that further allows them to stay in the world that they operate in.
Thank you, Dr. Asif, for your very insightful, you know, contribution on these issues you have mentioned. I have to admit on your extraordinary knowledge on these issues, to be honest. Just considering to our short time for this program, I would like to ask you about any recommendation, any idea about what the world should do, what should be done to do something, to make some reform, to bring some changes, or at least to make a peaceful environment in the scholarly environment of Islamic centers like madrasas in our region, in our world, because that's important. And day by day, we are witnessing increasing terrorist and extremist activities in Islamic territories, in Islamic countries, that is affecting other parts of the world. If you have any particular recommendation, any idea?
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I think that I would argue that madrasas, the biggest problem madrasas are creating is hate speech. Even if they are, various research tells us that those madrasas which are actually and directly involved in militancy might be not more than 10%. But even that's a big number because there are many madrasas. The others, I will not let the others go scot-free. What I mean is that many madrasas, maybe 50% of the madrasas, the religious narratives produced there create such hatred, which facilitates then violence in the second or third stage. What we can do about it, there are two or three things. First and foremost, I would highly encourage scholars in the West, for example, which I guess they're our audience as well, to also go and visit these madrasas. And they will be pleasantly surprised that there is room for engagement. When I went to a recent trip of these madrasas in Pakistan, the biggest concern I heard from them was, young people said to me in these madrasas, they said, actually, this was the first question I got in Madrasa Haqqaniya, where all the professors and teachers were sitting. It took quite a while for me to be comfortable with them and they to be comfortable with me. But that's a story to be told in some other day in any of your programs. But the first question they asked me was, sir, please tell us why people outside this madrasa hate us. And I stopped for a minute and I thought, no, if that's the feeling they have, because they're already getting a limited view from their curriculum and their lack of critical thinking and lack of variety of perspectives. And if further they think that everyone hates them, which might be partially true, then this is a problem. So more engagement with the madrasas. More scholars should go there. That's the first role at an individual level. Think tanks should go and visit these madrasas. Talk to those people and ask them one question. If we'll tell them, okay, this is what new package we have brought in, they will feel that we are about to take the control of their madrasa or we are against Islam. So it should not be a confrontational engagement. We should ask them, what do you want? Probably they'll ask for computers. Probably they'll ask for more books. And that's where the opportunities of engagement are. Secondly, the government, in case of especially Pakistan, Afghanistan also, because now they are building a new chain of madrasas. Afghanistan, even despite the Talibanization and all the challenges, madrasas, and you would know far more than me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but madrasas were not main source of education provision. There's this new network of madrasas that is being built in Afghanistan today. And this is the time for the West, though all those countries which are engaging with Afghanistan, providing some humanitarian aid and others, to say that, no, we want to ensure to look at the curriculum or engage with them. So the government, for instance, in countries like Pakistan, India also, Bangladesh I should have mentioned earlier, they need to involve these madrasas education system within the larger education system somehow. So that the person that is produced from the madrasa is not just good for an imam, because then they will fight to create a mosque, and where there already are mosques, the infighting, the battle for space, religious space, will further aggravate. The ways for the state to offer them, you'll teach religious studies, but you'll also teach chemistry, mathematics, physics, so that the person who's a graduate can also go for a job if he or she wants to do that. And also to push for, if they are not women in these madrasas with men, at least invest in separate madrasas for women as well. Because you might be able to create and facilitate and encourage religious education among women as well. That might create a new opening for religious discourse.
Thank you, Dr. Asif. As you have mentioned, the establishment of China madrasas in Afghanistan, it's a big concern for all intellectuals and Afghan people right now, because if you compare the number of madrasas with the other schools, primary and secondary schools in Afghanistan nowadays, there are 23,000 madrasas and there is only 18,000 schools. It means there is a kind of prioritization of madrasas to ordinary schools in Afghanistan in the policies and politics of the Taliban. And this is a great concern nowadays for our region. However, thank you so much for your participation in joining us today in this episode of WINS Podcast. The topic is very large. It's very wide. And we hope to have you again in our next programs to listen more about the madrasas and radicalism in Afghanistan in our region. Thank you so much for joining. Hope to have you again soon. Thanks.